This is Through the Rear View, a podcast from Three Aspens Media. I'm your host, Lindsay Young. On this show, we look back with the leaders, innovators, and storytellers who have helped shape their industries. We unpack the lessons they've learned, the pivots they've made, and the legacies they've built. It's a chance to reflect, reconnect, and get a view of what really matters. In this season, we're focused on the wholesale distribution industry. Enjoy. Hi, everyone. I'm Lindsay Young. I'm the founder of Three Aspens Media. And today I will be talking to Dan Judge. He's the founder of NetPlus Alliance. He has a rich family history and distribution. His roots trace back to the Erie Canal era in Lockport, New York, when his family's business, Ward Brothers Mill Supply, was providing critical tools and supplies to factories along the waterway. Over the years, he's played a pivotal role in transforming and expanding that business, starting as a kid in the business and eventually becoming president and leading key industry associations. Notably, he was instrumental in the formation of the Industrial Distribution Association, which is now the Industrial Supply Association, and played a key role in pioneering one of the first industrial distributor buying groups, ID1. Later, he founded NetPlus Alliance, a group that continues to help independent distributors grow through supplier partnerships. And his daughter, Jennifer Murphy, now runs NetPlus, a successful succession plan that we'll talk about a little bit later. Dan still lives in Lockport, although right now you're in Florida for the summer or for the winter, which is about 20 miles north of Buffalo. He served our country as a U.S. Army Signal Corps lieutenant, including in Vietnam. Thank you, Dan, where he was first introduced to changes in technology. And personally, I've worked with Dan for years, putting together the NetPlus Alliance Industry Outlook. And before that, I interviewed him multiple times for articles when I was the editor of Modern Distribution Management. So I am thrilled to have him as a guest and to hear his story and learn from his experience. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks, Lindsay. I'm honored to be your first.
Yes, I'm so excited that you're my first. It's perfect. As I said, you grew up in a family business. You led the family business. Now you work with family businesses. What are some of the unique aspects of growing up in or working for a family business?
Well, I think one of the interesting things is, and I know from my friends in the industry, is in a family business, you start when you're a kid. And I used to go down with my father on Saturdays to help put stuff away. I was probably 8, 10, 12 years old.
Yeah.
Putting away pipe fittings, they then came in burlap bags and you dump them in a bin. So that was my job. And most of the time I probably got them in the right bin. I started full time at Ward Brothers in 1969. You mentioned I'd been in the Army. I came back from Vietnam, went to the University of Buffalo and got my MBA. And so I started in September 1969. My father had retired. He'd been in the business since around 1930. Sam Ward, who was his first cousin, owned the business at that time. And as an ID graduate, an MBA graduate, you go to a business like that. You go into the family business. Even though I knew everybody, they thought I knew everything, you know. And frankly, I didn't know anything really about running a business like that. Sam felt they should probably be an operations type person rather than get into sales. And he was probably right. I think that's always been my niche, is to be involved in operations. And so that's what I did. I think the other thing that my father and Sam both taught me was to be involved in the community. Sam was very active in the community. My father was. Lockport was a city of about 20,000 people. So at one time I served on the Red Cross board. Another time I was on the United Way board, country club board. You had to do those things when you were in a community business.
Awesome. So you often talk, because you've been in the business for a long time, you often talk about how you've watched the evolution of technology, which is amazing, right? It's changed a lot since you first, you know, were stocking, pouring parts out of a burlap bag as a kid, right? So Tell me a little bit about, one of the things that you've talked to me about is the inventory card system upgrade, for example. So, which was one of your first jobs. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about technology is I actually went from handwritten everything. Our shipping documents was a 5-part form that our salespeople would write the orders on. One part was a packing list, one part was a delivery receipt, one part was the accounting copy, and then 2 invoices for the customers. Mm-hmm. So not only did you have to write them all, you had to press hard. They were 5-part interleaved with carbon paper.
Carbon copies, right?
They were carbon copies. Some people are probably going to have to look up to see what carbon paper is. We actually did a demo in our office a few years ago to show the young people what carbon paper was.
Whoa. That's amazing. And you really did have to press hard to get that to go all the way to press the last.
So then the order went to an inventory cabinet. It was like a Rolodex, big cabinets with rotary files. Every item had a card. There were 2 guys who would take the order, pull the card, write the quantity, the date, the quantity shipped, and then update the balance.
Whoa. So on a card.
On actual cards. They were maybe 4x6 cards. So Sam recognized that this system, which I don't know, was probably 20 or 30 years old, really needed to be updated. He hired a consultant to come in to help me plan this event. It was funny that the consultant was very good, and he really got us going down that road. And I said to him, Joe, who's in charge of all the inventory cards, he's got 20 years experience doing this. And he said, no, he said, Joe has 1 year's experience 20 times. And he was probably correct. So we bought a new manual system. It was called a busy record system. Each item was on a card, weighed them nicely typed. And I got all done, and I went into Sam and I said, we're all done. We have 16,000 items of inventory. And he said, no, we have 30,000 items of inventory. I said,
no.
There might have been 30,000 cards in there, but there's only 16,000. And it didn't really matter much to the sales pitch of the company. They still told people we had 30,000 items.
That's wild. So how did the technology you used evolve over the 70s?
Well, I really got into the technology when I was in Vietnam in the Signal Corps. I was part of a big Signal Corps battalion, but my job was with 6 or 8 non-commissioned officers. We'd go to the field with people like the 1st Cav Division and the 101st Infantry Division. Our job was to bring the communications from the 1 or 2-star general at the division up to a 3-star general at the Corps that we reported to. So we had radio teletype equipment. We had phone carrier equipment. We ran a switchboard. We ran wire. And we had a lot of different radio systems, single sidebar radio, FM radio. And it was pretty fascinating. And just the leadership experience of working with these 8 to 12 people continually. I didn't know much about the equipment. That was their job. But it was pretty fascinating. And one thing that I remember was in November 1965, there was a tremendous battle in the Iadrang Valley. And we actually could listen. We monitored all the radio transmissions. We weren't near it, although we weren't really too far. And it became a movie called We Were Soldiers. A fascinating movie, and we were a little part of it just because we listened into it.
Right.
And then when I was at Ward Brothers, we bought another company called Beals, McCarthy, and Rogers, changed our name to Ward Beals. And they were a pretty large City of Buffalo distributor. they had a big steel service center, and the owner wanted to peel the industrial supplies off. And we bought that part of the business. They had a big contract with Bethlehem Steel, who employed about 25,000 people at that time in Buffalo. And the orders were transmitted to us by dataphone. The dataphone was the customer. Bethlehem Steel had a tray with IBM punch cards. Again, I should have one to hold up.
Yeah. How big were they?
And they were IBM cards. So they were, you know, like that.
So almost like an index card-ish.
Yeah, wider than an index card. And okay. They had a card for every item. They would put the card into a reader, enter the quantity on a little keypad, and transmit it. And at our end, we had an IBM key punch with a receiving device. And that card would print out with the item the customer wanted and the quantity. So it was and they were, you know, like 40 miles away from us. So it was convenient for everybody. It was we'd probably get two or three orders a week from them with 20 to 50 items. Of course, we still then had to handwrite the orders because we were still on a manual system, but at least we got the orders quick. In the mid 70s, we had heard about a service that would provide basically an ERP system. It was called Distronix. The computers were in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. We still hand wrote the orders, but from then on, everything was a lot more computerized. We had four girls who sat at a terminal. It was like an IBM Selectric typewriter with a terminal. Transmit all the data to Cherry Hill, New Jersey. They'd run all their programs at night, print invoices, purchase orders, all the general ledger information, package it up, and ship it by Greyhound bus to us. So every day we'd go to, there was a Greyhound bus station in Lockport, and we'd go pick up this package with all of our stuff.
So would you do with that? Would you then update your books and stuff with that information? Is that how that worked?
The inventory was online in that computer, the general ledger, all the accounting information. So the only manual part of the system was writing the orders. Then once the order was ready to be build, it would go to one of these terminals and they'd enter the data. So I was going to mention one other technology thing that we did was we put in a automated storage and retrieval system. Lion Metal Products built a device called the Minitrieve. And I know we saved a lot of space. We saved a lot of time picking orders, and we had, you know, most of our small parts and stuff were there. But, you know, through the 70s and 80s, we were pretty technologically advanced compared to other distributors in the area.
It's impressive. It's so interesting to think back to that evolution, because even going from handwritten to, you know, sending over via the IBM, what do you call them? See, I'm showing my age now. The IBM cards that they had to
IBM
like,
cards, yeah.
To having, I mean, is that ERP system that was, you know, in New Jersey that you had to, you know, transmit via Greyhound bus, but every single step was an improvement in efficiency over the last, right?
Oh, no question. Yeah.
Even though it sounds very...
And accuracy, you know, the billing was more accurate. The inventory was more accurate. It was a lot easier to close the books at the end of the month because it was done on a computer and not on some posting machine.
That's awesome. So you actually then built an internal ERP system.
Yeah, we did.
The business in the 70s, right? The precursor to Profit 21 was being developed at the time, right? So what was that process like?
Well, there was six. So that online time-sharing service was called Distronics. And there was about, they had about 20 or 30 customers. And six of us getting together at one of their users' meetings said, you know, there's a better way of doing this if we could do it in-house instead of transmitting.
Dan, can I stop you for a second? Was Distronics a precursor to Profit 21? Or was that a different business?
Distronics was, no, it was not part of Profit 21.
Profit 21
people weren't involved.
Thank you for clarifying.
On Distronics. So six of us decided that we think, you know, we really bit off a lot. You know, we're going to develop an ERP system for distribution.
Yeah.
And we started in 1979. It was very intense. We would meet almost every other week at the O'Hare Hilton for two or three days. We hired a programming firm. We negotiated an arrangement with Honeywell to be the computer supplier. And they would market the system when we were done. We really had to get into the minutiae of distribution, and fortunately all six of us were operations guys, because we had to just get into how's everything going to work. And it's interesting when you start digging into that depth. We're talking about the billing, and I said, well, we got to talk about sales tax. And people were from, I think, all six different states. Some states didn't have sales tax. Some had a flat percentage. I said, well, New York State, we have a sort of a two-tier sales tax. There's a state tax of 4%. And there's a county tax, which could be 1 to 3, depending on what the county wanted to have added to the sales tax. And a customer could be exempt, or items could be exempt, or customers could pay it themselves. Well, I don't know how many hours of programming I added to the whole project, but it was, I mean, the other five couldn't believe the complexity of New York. And it's still that. In New York, it's still that way. But that was the kind of minutia we'd have to get into the system. We launched it in 1982, so it took us 3 years, really, to get going. We got our Honeywell computer. It was big. The CPU was the size of a refrigerator. The two hard drives that we had were like having a washing machine and a dryer sitting in your office. And it had 1 megabyte of memory. I think my watch probably has 100 times or 1,000 times that. But it revolutionized the way we did business. It improved our cash flow. Our inventory was spot on. We put a terminal on everybody's desk. So every customer service person got a Honeywell computer terminal. Printers in the warehouse, and we had a remote warehouse. They could have their own printer and terminal. And I was, you know, we're saying, well, how are the inside salespeople going to go from a handwritten form to entering the orders on a computer? I mean, it sounds, today everybody's got a computer.
Yeah.
Most people
have. They didn't back then. I mean, I didn't have a computer when I was a kid. So,
yeah. And I was really worried about a couple of the people were older. There was one woman, Eileen, was probably in her late 50s, early 60s, thinking, how is she going to take to this? Is she going to know how to enter and do it consistently. Well, Eileen loved it because her fingers had gotten kind of arthritic and she was really struggling writing the orders. And once she could just type in, she grew up knowing how to type. Once she could type the orders in, it was, she was really happy.
Amazing.
John Meggett was developing Prophet 21 at the time. Okay. He was using IBM hardware. And I think IBM was helping them sell their systems, probably launched it about the same time we did. Honeywell did end up selling about a dozen of our systems. And then they got out of the computer business and we were done. But we kept using.
Yeah, I was wondering that. Yeah. I was wondering if you. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean,
of course, Prophet 21 is still around. They're part of Epicor. Yeah. Epicor is a NetPlus Alliance business services provider. So full circle.
Full circle. You guys were definitely ahead of the core, or ahead of the curve, not the core, having individual terminals on people's desks in the early 80s. That's impressive. It's impressive. So what key lessons, given all of the stories you just shared, what key lessons have you learned related to technology? So what do you wish you just did differently or what worked well? Because every one of those steps required change management, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I didn't really know the phrase at the time, but there's really two that come to mind. Is one of is embrace change. And learn from it. The other is we be an early adopter. Don't sit around and wait for something to happen. Just go for it, and never stop learning. You have to stay up to date. We had our strategic planning meeting last fall. Jennifer had a consultant come in to teach us about ChatGPT. Now, I had read about it and I looked at it, but I had not downloaded the app and I hadn't even tried it. He got us to download it. I think it was a couple hour session, maybe an hour in. He said, well, okay, go ahead and try something. Now, I've been lucky enough to go to Ireland half a dozen times to play golf. Actually helped organize some tours for small groups. So my question to ChatGPT was design a 7-day golf tour to Southwestern Ireland. And in 30 seconds, it came back with golf courses to play, places to stay. And it was perfect. It was exactly what I would have planned, that same golf courses, same places to stay. I mean, it was really incredible. So I was hooked. So you got to keep learning. What we have done differently probably would have been cheaper and easier to just wait for Prophet 21 developing your own system. But it worked fine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was an experience, right? You probably learned a lot from the process of developing that, how technology worked, what you had to consider, all of that. Dan, your family business was part of a group that started ID1 in 1994, right? So what was your inspiration to start that?
1987.
Yeah. I had the wrong date written down. Yeah. I apologize. So in 1987, you started ID1. So what was your inspiration for starting that group?
Well, as a result of all my networking opportunities with being on the NIDA committees and being part of the Distronics users group and then the Honeywell system that we developed. And then I was involved in a group called the Distributor Executive Network, which was about 10 distributors from around the country who got together 3 or 4 times a year to share ideas. And we sort of kept saying, well, what can we do better together? And one of the members, Murray Miller, who was part of a number of these events, worked for a company in Warren, Ohio called Trumbull Industries. they were mostly a plumbing and heating distributor with an industrial division also. And they had started, they were part of a group that started a company called C.L. Watt 5 years prior. And C.L. Watt was a buying group cooperative for plumbing and heating. And Murray said, I think we could just copy that for industrial supplies and use the group to leverage the volume of the group for rebates and purchases. So rebates and pricing. So we started recruiting distributors. It was kind of an exclusive group, like one distributor per market. We met 5 times a year and at the at a hotel near the O'Hare Airport. Tremendous amount of networking, really learned a lot, and you know, it became a pretty successful group. We actually hired an executive who had run C.L. Watt for a few years. So he had, you know, he knew how to manage the purchases and rebates and things like that. And eventually we sold our company to Trumbull Industries in 1990. So there was, yep. They had been part of Distronics. They were a Distronics customer, so I knew them there. They were the part of the group that developed the Honeywell system. And then we started ID1 together. So it was pretty easy to sell the business to them.
So what was it like then to transition from leading the distribution company to leading the purchasing cooperative? What skills carried over? What was new?
Yeah, so we sold the business in 1990. Trumbull, as I said, and 2 years later, there was a young man named Dan Holbrook who was running. He was a executive director for ID1. His father had been a member of ID1. They were in Indianapolis, a huge company. Bill was a kind of a pillar of the industry, and when they joined ID1, it gave us a lot of, really gave us a huge step up in the industry. And then 2 years later, he sold it to Granger, and his son took over running ID1. Unfortunately, he died very young. Trumbull had had us read the habits, 7 habits of highly effective people. And the number one habit is to be proactive. And the day after Dan passed away, I called the chairman of ID1 and said, I'd like that job. And Murray was happy to let me go because he knew I could probably do a pretty good job running it. And they, you know, I was marketing manager, but they had other people who could fill that role. So I took over running ID1 in 1993. We had about 40 members in 40 different markets, and then later on added a bearing and power transmission distributor. My industry experience, you know, helped a lot. My industry knowledge, my product knowledge, I knew how to negotiate with suppliers. But what was new for me was I'd always been my own boss, and now I reported to a board of directors of 7 people who reported to a membership of 40. Everything took much too long to execute. And the board turnover, you know, every 3 years, 3 guys would go off and 3 guys would come on. It was like you'd be retraining people. So that was something I had to learn to deal with. But what I learned personally was how to manage the purchasing, the reporting process for purchases and rebates, arranging and setting up meetings, because we, as I said, we met 5 times a year. I had to make sure we were skillfully avoiding any antitrust violations. And then as later on, I got involved in negotiating and managing national contracts when the ID1 members realized they covered the country and they might be able to go get national contracts with manufacturers around the country.
Cool. That's interesting. Yeah, sorry. I was going to say, it's interesting you talk about going from entrepreneurship or running things to having to report. That definitely is a different skill set. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure I would do fine in that situation, but I've been my own boss for
your life
very long time, so I can relate to that. Yeah. So you were a key player in the merging of two industrial distribution associations, right? CIDA. You say CIDA, you don't say CIDA, right? You say CIDA. CIDA and NIDA.
NIDA.
How was that process? And I guess what was the value to the industry of that evolution?
Well, those were two really old associations. They were probably 80 or years or more. CIDA was the Southern Industrial Distributors Association. NIDA was the National Industrial Distributors Association. So NIDA was everywhere but the South. They both, and we had a partnership with ASMA, the Association of Manufacturers. More words in there, but it was a manufacturers association. And NIDA and CIDA did a lot together. We our committees were all joint committees. The conventions were pretty much joint conventions. So when we got sort of talking about should we just be one association, and this is sort of the case probably in a lot of nonprofits, you got a management company or a management person running each group. So the CIDA was managed by Gary Buffington. NIDA was managed by Bob Clifton. The members of each group were very loyal to their managers, and they had worked with them for a long time. Anybody that was came up through the chairs with those two guys. Well, the officers met offline without the staff, which was not illegal, but highly frowned upon by the managers. And as it turns out, Bob Clifton was going to retire. So we saw that as a great opportunity to start the process. And we brought the management teams back in and said, this is what we want to do. And with Bob retiring, we didn't have anybody there that would sort of anchor the NIDA people. So I was vice president of NIDA, and Tom Reed was vice president of CIDA. So we were kind of the two guys that really did most of the legwork and how to put this together. We didn't really have any major issues. We just had to make sure the membership would vote for it, because each group would have to vote separately to approve the merger. CIDA was a little more, we had a little more concern about CIDA because their legacy past presidents were still very important in the industry. But once we got Bill Ziegler, who was the sort of the senior past president, to say, yeah, this is a good idea, then we knew we were okay. Tom and I ended up being co-presidents for a year and helped develop the bylaws. And Gary Buffington, who had been manager of CIDA, became the executive director. And the benefits, cost savings in staff and travel, the number of conventions that the groups had was reduced from 5 to 2. At the time, CIDA had their own convention in February. There was the Triple Mill Convention, which was the three associations met in May. There was a New England Association convention. NIDA had a Western States convention. And then there was a separate group called the Central States Industrial Distribution. It was a very strong association, but they were all NIDA members. And they actually had to become part of the merger, and they did. So we basically reduced it to two conventions, the Triple Mill and the one in November, which CIDA had made a pretty strong convention. the manufacturers and the suppliers were thrilled because they went from 5 conventions to 2.
That's much better. Yeah.
And of course, now with all the buying groups and the big, you know, their big customer shows and stuff, they have a lot more meetings. But then they were thrilled to go from 5 to 2. And I think the other benefit is ISA was able to start a foundation, basically with funds from the three groups who contributed to starting the foundation. So that was pretty a pretty good benefit out of that merger.
It's awful. So at the time you were running ID1, was there any controversy or challenges to being accepted as the, you know, when you became co-president as IDA? Was that unusual?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I was vice president of ID1, and while we're in the final stages of the merger, there was a lot of angst among the memberships of NIDA and CIDA about ID1. It was, you know, kind of an unknown entity. We sort of kept it very quiet, and we had, as I said, we had a restricted membership. So like in Buffalo, the Buffalo area, we were the member. In fact, we were the member for all of upstate New York. There were some other really good distributors who were upset that they could not be part of the group and couldn't get the rebates. And so you don't see this in the trade press today, but back then they would write letters, they would publish letters to the editor, kind of like in your local newspaper when somebody doesn't like something.
Wow.
And both the MDM and ID Magazine had articles from some very influential members of the association that were just livid about the buying group, about ID1. The fear was it was going to destroy the distributor supplier loyalty, that it was going to break away, that the loyalty would be to the buying group, not to the manufacturer. And that really hasn't happened. In fact, the relationship between the suppliers and the distributors is much stronger because of the buying group. So the distraction, it calmed down pretty quickly. There was some thought that I should be impeached.
Oh, as my.
co-president of IDA. And Tom Reed said, absolutely not. And for one, the bylaws don't have an impeachment clause.
Oh,
and number
gosh.
Two, you're not going to resign. So,
yeah. So
it kind of went away. And the distributors kind of that were in each market kind of got together and formed another group.
Amazing. So ID1 eventually voted to liquidate, right, and join affiliated distributors. Yeah, mm-hmm. For various reasons, right? Consolidation, changing tech requirements. But a couple of years later, you started NetPlus Alliance. So how did your mission at NetPlus differ from your mission at ID1?
Well, I think when I often get asked, why did, you know, at your age at that time, I was 60, why did I start a new business? Well, frankly, I needed a job.
And
I was on the board of a public bank, the First Niagara Financial Group, and one of the, mm-hmm. you know, one of the things, if you were on the board, you had to have a job. So between AD, the members leaving to go to AD and starting NetPlus, I had kept Carl Chapey and Shirley Weiland, who worked for me at ID1. They actually stayed with me, and we dabbled in a couple of other things. And I had three friends who were retired industry executives who helped sort of craft this. We would sit around saying, what can we do? And somebody said, why don't we just do a buying group for industrial supplies distributors. We had this, we bought the software from ID1. So we knew how to manage rebates and national contracts. As I said, I had kept Shirley and Carl, and I had a lot of buying group knowledge from the National Cooperative Business Association that I had been a part of. So we said, you know, we can do this. We can start a group. There's 10,000 industrial distributors. There's 100 in AD. So we got a big market. We know the suppliers. So we built a group for small and mid-sized distributors, help them grow their business, grow their profitability. And I said, well, this is going to be a sort of a one man, one vote situation. I'm not going to report. It's not going to be a cooperative. I'm not going to vote, you know, work with a board of directors. We'll just do it ourselves. It was going to be a no-frills group, no meetings, no national contracts, no central accounts payable, just nice and clean. We sent out a press release in September 2002 announcing the start of the buying group, sent it out to the magazines and the MDM, and the internet news services were just starting for the various magazines. So they had... ID Magazine had an article online the next day about this new buying group. And Pat Sibick, who was the VP of sales at Rayovac, called me that day and he said, if you're starting this group, we're in. And, nice. And some other suppliers did the same thing. So we were able to build the supplier side and then went out to recruit distributors. And after a couple of years, we'd made two acquisitions of small groups and we had 190 members and 100 suppliers.
Incredible. Incredible. Yeah. Once that press release went out, you were committed. Yeah. Like, we're doing this. That's incredible. So speaking of, you said that it was a no frills group initially. And one of those tenets was not to have an annual meeting. But then you ended up adding one with IDA. Right? Just having a meeting. Yep. I remember, actually, back when I was the editor at MDM, I remember attending the NetPlus meetings at ISA, which is, you know, for those listening, the successor to IDA. How did that come about?
Well, the no annual meeting thing really came about because I have a younger brother who's in the automotive aftermarket. He was VP of sales for a couple of different companies. And we were talking when I was going through this planning. He says, you distributors in your meetings, he said, he had one, the prior year he had 26 weekends that he had to go to different meetings, groups, companies, you know. I said, well, meetings are kind of a pain. We won't even have one. Well, so the first couple of years, I would get a hospitality suite and we'd have beer and wine. And basically we'd invite our distributors and our suppliers. But of course, the distributors at that time were all getting entertained and going to manufacturer parties. So the people who came to our party were the suppliers. And we just had beer and wine, and Shirley would bootleg in pretzels and potato chips because we didn't have to pay the fee that the hotel was going to charge us. And then in May of 2005, Jan Buckley, who had taken over running IDA from Gary, he and I got to know each other pretty good, and he invited us to use their convention as our annual meeting. So we had a luncheon meeting for our distributors, and they had one day of the convention where the distributors were in the booth instead of the suppliers. And so he put all of our members in one booth, in one aisle. He hung a aisle signs over our aisle saying NetPlus Alliance. We had ribbons on our badges that said NetPlus Alliance. You can imagine the reaction from the people at AD and IBC, because net plus doing getting this special attention. Next year, obviously, all the groups had the same treatment.
John Buckley was such a champion.
Yeah, and then we started our own standalone meeting in 2014.
Amazing. So actually, and I've been to many of your annual meetings, your standalone meetings. I mean, the last one had record attendance, right? So is there a lesson there in, you know, the willingness to evolve that other businesses can learn from?
Well, I think the interesting thing was we listened to our partners. Jennifer had started a supplier advisory committee, and they pushed us hard to have a meeting. And they said, you know, it's really doesn't make any sense that you've got this group of distributors. We'd like an opportunity to sit with them. And one of them, you know, so we said, okay, that sounds like a good idea. And one of them said, well, you really need to have a golf outing. And our company will throw in $5,000 and I'll get half a dozen other companies, suppliers to put in $5,000. And you can have a golf outing and the distributors won't have to pay to go golf. And we still have a golf outing. And as you said, we have a very, very successful, meeting.
Well, it just goes to show you that even today, when you and I you can be sitting in Florida, I'm in Colorado, we can meet, see each other's faces. There's still a lot of value. A lot of distributors and suppliers still see a lot of value in coming together face to face.
No question.
Yeah. So you mentioned Jennifer. So your daughter, you know who your daughter is, but for everybody else, your daughter, Jennifer Murphy, she joined the company in 2005 as the marketing director. So then she became the fifth generation president. It was, I believe, 2013. And the sole owner in 2023. Do I have those dates right?
Yes. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So when it came time to pass NetPlus Alliance to Jennifer, how did you know? How did you know that it was the right time to step back?
Well, Jen had been living in Boston with her husband, Tom, and she was very involved in marketing for a international education company who arranged trips for high school and college people to around the world. They decided to move back to Lockport after she had her second child. We were talking and I said, well, why don't you, just come down, see what you can help us with. She's a marketing person. Everybody who knows Jennifer knows she's a marketing person. And I actually gave her a kind of a dumb assignment at first, but it helped her learn the business. I had her recruiting distributors from Canada, and that didn't work because Canadian distributors wanted to stay in Canada. So I said, well, what about what we're doing with marketing? Carl Chapey had been putting together this little 4-page black and white newsletter we would send out. He'd have the suppliers send us stuff and we'd put it in the newsletter. She says, Dad, you know, the suppliers will pay to advertise in the newsletter. And I said, oh, they won't. They're not going to do that. Of course they did. And we went to a color newsletter and we went to 8 pages instead of 4. And, as she got more involved and she learned a lot more about the business, after a few years, probably in the, maybe early 2010s, she became kind of the chief operating officer and started to learn other parts of the business, mostly because I started going to Florida for 4 months a year and kind of left her back in charge. In 2012, she completed a program at the University of Buffalo called the Center for Entrepreneurial Leadership. It was a really intense one day a week for a year program. And she would come back after each session and grill me on, well, who's our accountant and who's our attorney and why do we do this and why do we do that? And It was, you know, it was a tremendous program for her, and it's still a very strong program at UB. She started our first strategic planning session with one of the executives from UB, Rick Wallace, who was a consultant. Most of the CEL trainers were people in the community, not UB faculty. So these were people that had real business experience. And so Rick came in and did our strategic planning. And I don't know, it's maybe the next year, I'm thinking, you know, Jennifer could really be president of the company. And I asked Rick, we met for coffee, and he said, it's a no-brainer, you know. Awesome. So that was it.
That was it.
Yeah.
It. And from there, did you know that you would one day give her the business, basically hand it down to her?
I figured it's at some point we would work something out along that line. And it was easy to turn the business over to her. It was easy to let, you know, name her president. And, you know, I knew she was good at managing the supplier distributor relationships. She's a great personal people person. She built a great team, and I could go away and not worry too much about it.
That's great. There are a lot of lessons in such a successful transition for other family businesses, and there's a lot of them out there right now thinking about this. There always have been. So what do you think worked well for you in that transition, for you to pass the business to her?
Well, I think the most important the most important thing for a successful transition is to get out of the way and let the person who you've named to run the business, let them run the business. You know, give advice when asked. And I, you know, I stay in, you know, I think it's probably important to stay in touch. I'm still in touch with, we have a weekly huddle, and I'm still involved in that. And I go to the annual planning meetings and just watch the business grow. But I think definitely getting out of the way is a key thing for a transition.
Is it hard after you've been running the show for such a time?
It wasn't.
You're like, I'm good.
I know she could do a good job, and she had a really good team.
And you did that. We've talked about this in the past, and I know that when you made that decision and saw that coming, you started that process pretty early. It's not like the year that you decided to pass the business to her, you're like, all right, let's just do this, and signed a paper and walked away. Like, you actually had a plan and a process.
Yeah, it was actually over, it like over a 5-year period, actually transferring the ownership. And, you know, and when I did it, I had to sort of take care of her sister as well. Jen has a sister, Karen, who's very successful in her own right, is a principal of a Catholic elementary school. And so I would, you know, when I would pass parts of the business to Jennifer, I'd also pass equal value to Karen. And so we work, you know, with a local accounting firm and law firm, and created, you know, the right way to do it, and did it over a five year period.
Awesome. So any lessons that you learned in that process that other companies could learn from?
No, I think, as I said, just getting out of the way, getting, you know, having some expert advice in how to do it, both from an accounting side and the legal side. And then just letting it roll.
So we have a few questions that we're asking of everyone who's participating in this program. So let's dive into those now. So if you could go back, that long history that we just went over, go back and give advice to yourself when you were just starting out in this industry, maybe not when you were 8, maybe a little older than that, but what would it be?
Well, I think, I guess I had wished I had learned earlier to be proactive. I think maybe Ford Beals might have been a different company if I had really, I didn't really know how to be the leader of a company like that. And there wasn't anything like CEL that Jennifer went through, and the associations were, they had some stuff going on, but again, it was more operational oriented than leadership and management oriented. So I wish I'd had more of that kind of experience. And also, it didn't take long, but I think pursuing change, I could have maybe done more things within the business and embracing change. So I wish I had learned those earlier. And the other thing I wish I had learned, and I'm not sure how you learn it, is to remember people's names.
Oh, gosh.
I'm not very good at that. Unfortunately, I got people in the company that are good at that. So when we're going up to somebody, okay, who's that? I know he knows me and I know him, but I don't,
Yeah. I love name tags at conferences for that very reason, Dan. I can relate. When you say you wish you were more proactive with your, with Edward Beals, what do you mean? Like you said, you could have done more. Are there things now looking back that you would have, you know, was it expansion or other?
Yeah, probably like expansion and maybe not. We sold the business in 1990 because Sam Ward wanted to sell the business and get his capital out of it. I did not pursue at all trying to buy it. The economy in Western New York had really kind of gone downhill. Bethlehem Steel had closed their plant. You know, GM's business was getting smaller. So I never pursued that. You know, maybe I should have. And, you know, who knows? Things might have been different, but things turned out pretty well. You know, the way it is.
I would agree. What's one thing about the so-called old school way of doing business that you think still adds value today?
Oh, I think it's, you know, the personal relationships are really the key, you know, key to the success. And in like one example, it goes back to when I was running Ward Beals. We had a purchasing agent, really close friend named Carl Puzio. Mm. And Carl was at Carborundum as purchasing agent, and we had all of their mill supply business. And then Carl left and went to a different company. We kept the business at Carborundum. Where he went, we had no business. All of a sudden, we're that customer's mill supply distributor. Mm-hmm. After a couple of years, he left there and went to a third job. Same thing. We picked up three accounts.
And he's your best sales guy right there.
Yeah. And then when he retired, he was one of the three guys that came to work with us and helped. He was a great negotiator. So he did a lot of our supplier recruitment. And the same thing continues in our current industry. And you see it because key supplier personnel change. Mm-hmm. And they move. And to some extent, even the distributors, we have some new distributors joining NetPlus because a distributor executive left and went to another company or left to start another company. And we pick up new distributors and certainly on the supplier side, there's a lot of movement in that area, and the relationships that we've built with those people is key to getting new suppliers and new distributors.
So final question. Thank you for bearing with me, Dan. I know this has been a long conversation, but it's been fascinating. Based on your knowledge and experience, what do you think should excite the next generation of leaders in this industry?
Well, I think it's, you have to be excited about what you're doing. You have to like what you're doing. You've got to grow with whatever business you're in and do it well. That's, you know, you have to be changing all the time. And you certainly have to grow with this rapid pace of technological innovation. And I know it's really hard for people to keep up with the volume of emails and the volume of text messages, but you've got to just continue to grow. Who knows where artificial intelligence is going to take us? Maybe that helps people get less emails or deal with their emails in a different way.
That'd be nice.
See, yeah, but it's been interesting going from a 5-part handwritten form to a computer on my wrist.
That's crazy. It's wild. Well, Dan, thank you for spending the time with me, sharing your story, sharing your lessons learned. I really appreciate that. I appreciate that. And hopefully our listeners appreciate hearing your story as well.
Thanks, Lindsay. It's been a real pleasure. Enjoyed
it. Thank you.